Welcome to Guerrilla Radio. Well, welcome to The Great Undoing, an experiment in media-induced social dissonance. So fantastic. For sanity's sake, it's essential you date all notifiers to remind you this is indeed 2017. Yes, much more than a homage to the days of yore, America's new model year president is a wholesale throwback to a time before your mother was born. Reference the archive under Cleaver, June, Smith, Kate, and Hudson Rock. Somebody should tell the chief about that one. But even more frightening than Mr. T's medievalist social policy is the unmitigated unfettering of the monsters he and his fellow Frankensteins in finance would loose on Wall Street and the world. Joyce Nelson is an award-winning Canadian freelance writer, researcher, and author whose articles appear in the Watershed Sentinel and at counterpunch.org. Her book titles include The Perfect Machine, TV in the Nuclear Age, Sultans of Sleaze, Public Relations in the Media, Sign Crimes, Roadkill, From Mediascape to Landscape, and just in time, the newly released Beyond Banksters, Resisting the New Feudalism. Joyce Nelson in the first half. And this week, Victoria hosts the 23rd Victoria Film Festival, boasting a program of more than 120 theatrical features, shorts, documentaries, animated Canadian and international films, just one of which is The Skyjacker's Tale, Canadian director Jamie Kastner's documentary chronicle of murder and intrigue in the lower latitudes, and Ismail Muslim Ali's desperate flight from the law. Jamie Kastner and The Skyjacker's Tale in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher emeritus and CFUV radio broadcaster Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to bring us news of the good goings on plan for the streets of our town and beyond in the coming week. But first, Joyce Nelson, Beyond Banksters. Stick around. Welcome back to the program, Joyce.
Hi, Chris. I can barely hear you.
I'll speak up there. How's that? Any better?
That's a little better.
Okay. Well, Joyce, congratulations on your new release. You know, I imagined, Joyce, that when you wrote Beyond Banksters, Resisting the New Feudalism, you expected we'd be resisting Queen Hillary right about now. Does it mean a tinker's dam to your book's thesis that King Donald took the throne instead?
Well, you're right. I was expecting, like most people, I was expecting that Hillary would be elected. I would say that it does make a difference. It's a little bit of a difference in a way. I think both Trump and Clinton adhere to the neoliberal economic model that Milton Friedman advanced, and that's basically trickle-down economics, deregulation, privatization of public assets, austerity budgets for everybody else, that kind of thing. So it's, in that sense, they're both alike. I think under Trump, things are much more brutal and fast and quick. And we're seeing that already in his first 2 weeks. You know, they're moving fast. And under Hillary, that might have been, it might have looked less brutal, a little more subtle, but it's the same economic model. Well, I also noticed that one of the key figures in Beyond Banksters is a financial expert named Larry Fink, who's the head of BlackRock, which is the biggest investor in the world. So they advise on $15 trillion with a T, dollars, and to about 100 investors worldwide, and Larry Fink was pretty much expecting, at least that was the gossip in the financial pages, Larry Fink was expecting to be the Treasury Secretary under Hillary Clinton. So it's interesting that after the election, he's now advising Trump.
Yeah.
So he jumped ship.
Well,
and now advising Trump. He's part of the I think it's 18 different CEOs that have been brought together under Steve Schwarzman to advise Trump. So that sort of says a lot, that it doesn't really matter who's in place.
Yeah.
As the president, it's the people that are in the administration in key places that are the real movers.
Yeah, well, this reminds me of when Barack Obama first took over, and his foreign policy advisors and Homeland Security mavens were all taken straight from the Bush administration that preceded him. In this case, I can't help but think about poor old Ralph Nader when he wrote a book saying that the billionaires should come and take over America to help us. And be careful what you wish for, Ralph, because as you mentioned, we've got all these billionaires pulling the levers of power directly now. They don't even have to go through the middleman, which I guess Mr. Trump would say is just good business, eh?
I've never read that Nader book, but maybe it was satire. I don't know.
No, I think he thought that they would come and help us, but no. One of the first things, and the Trump administration announced this last week, it was almost right out of the gate, was to eviscerate what checks had been put on Wall Street. I mean, the Steagall Act had already been, weakened to such a degree, but now Trump has torpedoed the whole thing, and he's going to give, by the looks of it, unfettered rein to the same people who drove the 2008 financial disaster again.
Well, the Glass-Steagall was totally undone back in 1999. So this is different. He's aiming at Dodd-Frank, which was supposed to, which was passed in 2010. It was supposed to make some corrections and changes to the financial industry so that a similar crash couldn't happen again. So he's wanting to undo that. And you're right in the sense that that's been heavily lobbied for by the financial industry. And he's, even though he was, verbally against Goldman Sachs and others and criticizing Hillary for her speeches to Goldman Sachs, he's got six appointees that are Goldman Sachs alumni. So the swamp is not being drained, it's being enlarged.
And it's not frozen in Canada either, because our own, our former Bank of Canada leader was a Goldman Sachs alum, and so is the current one.
Is that right?
Yeah, as
well,
far as I know.
I know Mark Carney was, and the current one is also?
Yeah, that's what I read anyway, and he actually...
Stephen Poulos?
He even looks like Mark Carney. If you saw them together in a room, I'm sure you'd think that they were related by more than their financial history. Well, what is it, Joyce, about Goldman Sachs and their reign over the banking systems in the United States and in Canada and Britain and elsewhere?
Oh, well, this I think I've read this is the fourth administration that where the the key administration is pretty much run by Goldman Sachs. I can't explain their power. I don't know what their power is. They certainly have it, though.
Well,
of course, they're not the only ones. These are huge billionaires. These are huge masters of money.
Well, you've written, Joyce, in the past about the Bank of Canada and how what the Bank of Canada could do to revitalize the Canadian economy and establish more strongly our autonomy here. What's your take on how this fares in this new Trump era?
Well, there's a think tank in Toronto, a small think tank called the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform, and many of your listeners probably will have heard of the Bank of Canada lawsuit that they've launched. They launched it in 2011. It's been a slow process, but now they're taking the case to the Supreme Court. This is to return the Bank of Canada back to what it used to do for 35 years, from 1938 until 1974. The Bank of Canada was making loans to the federal and provincial governments, so very, very low interest loans, and which then were repaid and reinvested in similar loans. So the private sector was not making the loans. The private lenders were not making the loans, and that seemed to work really well for infrastructure. It got us. Got Canadians through World War II and quite a lot of infrastructure building in those decades, and even money for healthcare and for you know, education and old age security. So infrastructure was well funded during those years without running up inflation or without running up private debt. And part of what Beyond Banksters is about is looking at why was that change made in 1974? What prompted Gerald Bowie, the governor of the Bank of Canada at the time, to drop that system that had worked so well and instead, you know, change it to allow the private sector to start loaning money into Canadian provinces and feds? And, you know, as a result of doing that, as Paul Hellyer has made really clear, Canadians are paying about, well, they've paid since 1974 over $1.1 trillion, with a T, trillion dollars in interest for those loans to the private sector. We've paid to the private sector for those loans. And, for example, last year, as I recall, the federal, which is called servicing the debt, paying off those that interest on those loans, servicing the debt. So last year, the feds, our federal government, paid, I think it's $25 billion. That's just our interest charges. That's not paying off the debt. That's paying off the interest owed. So this keeps happening year after year. For example, in Ontario, the servicing the debt charges in 2015 were over $11 billion. It's a huge amount of money that we pay every year just to just for interest charges on the loans. And that didn't happen when the Bank of Canada was making the loans. So this Comer lawsuit is to get us back to that system that worked so well.
Well, and Mr. Trump he campaigned mightily on reinstating America's infrastructure. This kind of setup would certainly help in that effort, but it doesn't seem like that's the direction he's going with his light hand on Wall Street and the banks.
Well, we'll see what's going to happen. As I said, the Justin Trudeau Liberals are bypassing that Comer lawsuit, and they're setting up a different bank called the Canada Infrastructure Bank, which would likely be, again, borrowing heavily from the private sector and working with the private sector on infrastructure. So that is the same kind of situation that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have been talking about, some kind of infrastructure bank. And we don't know the parameters of what that will be in the States yet. And we don't fully know the parameters of what it'll be in Canada until the next budget comes out. And I think we may be in for some real surprises when that comes out. My worry is that there will actually be a push to then combine those two banks, combine the Canada Infrastructure Bank with whatever the bank in the States is, and that would be a disaster. The Justin Trudeau Liberals appointed someone, I've never been able to get the name, nobody has, they appointed someone from Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, to advise them on setting up this Canada Infrastructure Bank. There's no report has been released. It was supposed to be done by September, the report by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. They've never released the name of the person writing the report. They've never released the report. And so we don't know yet what that bank is fully going to look like, but it looks like it's going to be partially privatized already. And it's a clever way to get around the Comer lawsuit, which is saying, let's go back to what we had because it works so well.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Joyce Nelson. Joyce is an award-winning Canadian freelance writer and researcher. She's the author of the books The Perfect Machine, TV in the Nuclear Age, Sultans of Sleaze, Public Relations, and the Media. And her latest book is Beyond Banksters, Resisting the New Feudalism. Joyce, tell me about this book now. You got it published through the Watershed Sentinel, which on first blush doesn't seem like the kind of venue where you'd find an economics treatise published.
Well, it came about because my first piece, which is in the Beyond Banksters, my first piece on the Bank of Canada lawsuit, came out at Watershed Sentinel magazine last January, and Dolores Broughton, the editor there, and I had talked about, you know, that would be interesting to do. It would be interesting. She was interested in the topic, too, and so we brought it out. And it's been, that particular piece has been hugely popular on their website. Over 151,000 people have read that particular article from last January. So on the basis of that, we decided, and I'd done another piece for a different publication called Economic Reform, kind of following up on that and expanding further. And that, too, was very popular. So on the basis of that, Dolores Broughton and I decided to go forward with a book. I pitched it to her first, partly because I knew that this is very time-sensitive stuff. The book is like takes the reader right up to, you know, autumn, what's happening as of last autumn on these financial issues. And I knew, I checked in with some other book publishers, and most of them have a long wait list. In other words, they might be interested in your book, but you have to wait a year. Mm-hmm. So it worked really well to go with a bank, to go with Watershed Sentinel as their first book, because they're very nimble. They're, you know, it's kind of like, let's do it and let's get it out fast. So it's working out really well.
Well,
and I think they're excited about it too. Like, okay, there's other possible book projects in the works. So I don't know what they are yet, but I know there's been interest. So that's a really interesting direction for them to be going as well.
Well, at the pace of change, you're right. Being nimble is the only route to survival, it seems. And Mr. Trump, again, when he came in, he already announced that he was going to axe the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. You've written on trade deals, Joyce, TISA particularly, but also this general trend towards privatizing public services. What's your take on Mr. Trump's announcement about the TPP?
Well, all those four trade deals are dealt with in Beyond Banksters, and my sense is that I think it's really amazing and terrific to not have the TPP go forward, though it still could, I hear. But he's looking for bilateral, you know, just country to one country to another country arrangements, and that still makes, for example, makes Canada vulnerable because, you know, we're dealing, the mouse dealing with the elephant here.
Mm-hmm.
And they could, you know, I think everyone's wondering, what are they going to insist on? Of course, what we should be insisting on is that they drop investor-state dispute settlement clauses from NAFTA, drop anything about water from NAFTA, drop anything about trade and services, too, because I think that's what he wants. He wants to get trade and services in through NAFTA. That would probably mean he wants to privatize financial services, which means privatizing pensions. And there's a push in Canada. Let's have 18 million people that get their pensions through the CPP. Let's privatize that, they're saying, so that people, you know, have to deal with a financial analyst. They, of course, get fees, and they're it's pretty much a how do I say this? It's one of those situations where the U.S. has been. That's another thing that Trump's doing. He's trying to get rid of the what's called fiduciary duty around financial services. So it's a financial advisor is supposed to have the best interests of their client at heart, not their own best interests. But the way things are set up, they can push financial, you know, investment decisions for your pension money, whereby they get big perks, you know, a trip to the Bahamas, a whatever, all kinds of, you know, higher fees, just because they pushed it onto some poor, unsuspecting pensioner.
Oh, and when they get...
So I think that's one of the things that I think Trump wants to get through NAFTA, the privatization of financial services. We'll see, though.
Well, we saw what Mr. Martin did when he was at finance with the CPP and introducing the investment board, who who take our money by force of threat of imprisonment and invest it solely on the corporate ethos of maximizing profits. This attitude seems to go through. You know, I read just recently David Orchard, who'd long fought against NAFTA, writing a celebratory article about the impending death, if Mr. Trump has his way, of the NAFTA deal, something that he's been fighting for decades to have undone. But maybe his celebrations are a little premature.
We shall see. We don't know what they're going to want. And, of course, there was a big huddle recently where Trudeau's cabinet went into, it was somewhere, I can't remember where, in Alberta, but they, you know, did 2 days huddle. But it was interesting who was there. So who was invited into the huddle? You've got Dominic Barton, who's our so-called economic czar, advising our Minister of Finance about how to grow the economy. He's, of course, the top head honcho at McKinsey and Company, another figure in my book. So there in the huddle about NAFTA is Dominic Barton of McKinsey and also Steve Schwarzman, big financial investor from the States. So who knows what these people are cooking up, but it's kind of hold on to your assets is how I would put it.
Well, if you can, because like you say, if they're going to take away our pensions, and you've seen there's been attempts in the United States and there's been attempts here as well, that there's been at least talk around the edges of you know, getting their hands on these. I mean, what's a Canadian to do? You have to pay into your pension whether you like it or not if you're working, and you know what happens to it after that is a little bit beyond your control.
Yeah, there's that worry. There's also the other worry. A big focus in my book, Beyond Banksters, is on what's called asset recycling. Now, because I and others have written about that term, asset recycling, which is basically what Kathleen Wynne is doing here in Ontario, you know, sell off your, sell off your Hydro One transmission system in order to build transit lines. And this is called asset recycling. Mm-hmm. It makes no sense at all. Hydro One, for example, brings in over $700 million a year. So why would you sell it off? It's a moneymaker for the government.
Well, and why would BC Hydro out here drive this publicly controlled corporation into the ground the way they have done? You know, it makes one wonder. Joyce Nelson's
book. Well, that's because they're next, privatizing BC Hydro. Well, I was trying to recall. You've already privatized BC Rail, right? Has BC Ferries been privatized?
Not that I'm aware, but they brought in an American corporate head to take over a few years ago, and he took citizenship and a great pension plan and disappeared after a number of cuts and so forth. But it's still in our hands until it starts making money, I guess. then they'll get rid of it.
It looks like BC Hydro is going to be on the chopping block because these big financial players are going after. This is across the developed world right now. They're going after to privatize electricity systems because that's a steady moneymaker for them.
Well, and we can't do without it. Joyce Nelson's book is Beyond Banksters, Resisting the New Feudalism. You can go and find it at watershedsentinel.ca. Get links to that, and you can order online. Thanks a lot, Joyce, for coming on. And sorry about the rocky start there.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, then. Bye-bye. Now, I'm going to take a brief break, and when I come back, I'll be joined by Janine, All Things Going According to Hoyle. She's going to bring us up to speed with things going on around here in the coming weeks. So do stick around for that. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Joining me now, as oft time she does, is the Victoria Street News publisher emeritus and CFUV radio broadcaster in her own right, Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine.
Hey, Chris, it's beginning to look a lot like the next ice age out there.
we drove through it. It's almost gotten to the panic stage for Victoria, who's not used to this kind of weather.
Really, in February. But you'll be pleased to know that Christy Clark held a $1,000 a plate dinner last night. And outside where they were eating whatever they were eating, probably tortured and murdered animals, the Carnegie Community Action Project and the Raise the Rates groups were serving beans to folks who couldn't get a meeting with Christy Clark. They tried, but They figure if they had $1,000 each, maybe then she'd listen to them.
Well, that's a lot of money. My first question was, what were they having on the menu? But you don't know.
Well, yeah, I'm betting it wasn't anything vegan. So my motto right now, my hashtag, distinguish yourself. You know, there's these ultra wealthy people who are completely out of touch with the realities of what's going on in the world, and we can certainly distinguish ourselves by eating more compassionately. So, you know, people on welfare are surviving on welfare rates that haven't been raised in 10 years. We got an election coming up. You know, all kinds of things come to mind. Mount Polly, Site C. I mean, there's tons of stuff and some events coming up that are sort of starting to gear towards the election. So I'll get on with those because there's lots of them. The Retail Action Network is holding their Workers' Wednesday dinner in a movie edition. This is for retail workers and labor activists fighting for workplace justice, sort of outside the union, for people who aren't necessarily in unions, and I guess for union members too. They're having a community dinner tonight at 5. At 6:30, there's a film screen. It looks like they've got a new documentary they're going to be releasing soon. And then at 8:30, the Troublemakers Jam. So they're accepting your donations at the door. It starts at 5. Till 10 tonight at the Victoria Event Center. And then the Council of Canadians are having a public forum about the Site C Dam tonight, February 9th, 7:30 p.m., tomorrow night, pardon me, at David Turpin Building, Room A120. They're going to have a panel of speakers to talk about why the Site C is a profoundly costly mistake that would add 150,000 tons of greenhouse gas emissions to BC's carbon footprint. And if people are going to the film festival, I really recommend watching the Borneo case. It's the story of what happened to the rainforests of Borneo and the dams that were built that flooded the indigenous lands. I mean, it's a very familiar story, and we can certainly learn from their struggle, I think. So anyways, the Canadian Council's event is tomorrow night, 7:30, David Turpin Building at UVic. Also tomorrow, 7 o'clock, at the Mary Winspear Centre in Sydney, BC New Democrats are gearing up, and they have someone from the Community Social Planning Council to discuss affordable housing needs. David Eby will be coming over from Vancouver. He was an elected MLA in Vancouver Point Grey, which is Gordon Campbell's old riding, where Christy Clark couldn't get elected. And that's tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Mary Winspear Centre. On Saturday, there's a Reform the Vote Victoria rally. This is really to do with federal elections more so than the provincial, although if we could get electoral democracy anywhere, that would be great. So they're going to, hey?
Always looking for the stars, are you?
Well, we gotta hope. I mean, what else is there to do? We can climb into a snowbank and end it there, but we might as well just keep trooping forward. Saturday at 11 at Centennial Square. If you can't be there, there's petitions online. It's a Cross Canada event, and Saturday the 11th, go onto Facebook or Twitter and find Reform the Vote and get involved somehow or another. Also, to do with Standing Rock, can you imagine those people? I mean, imagine what it's like here. Never mind what's going on at Standing Rock in North Dakota. These people have been camped out all winter, right?
Yeah, and this is it's not the West Coast.
Right. I mean, it's cold enough out here. And I wanted to mention, too, you know, Christmas is a nice time for the homeless people and the poor people because there's a lot of extra stuff around them, goodwill and all that. But it really slows down in January. So if people have any extra change or anything they can throw somewhere, that's really helpful. Okay, Standing Rock, Saturday at 1 o'clock till 3 o'clock in Vancouver at Howe in Georgia. There's going to be an inter-action where they stand at an intersection and talk to people and hand out flyers and just try to raise awareness. That's in Vancouver Saturday. And then this weekend, you won't believe this, but there's some people are going to do a walk for justice from Duncan to Victoria.
Okay.
A walk for justice. I, you know, over the Malahat in this weather, and they're going to camp overnight. I don't know. Okay, 9:15 they're gathering February 11th in Duncan, and then they're going to camp somewhere, and then they'll be in Shawnigan Lake around February 12th, and then Goldstream to Victoria February 13th, and then the 14th to 17th there's solidarity vigils and various things at the legislature.
Oh, well, I understand. Okay? I understand the weather is going to be a little more seasonal by then.
Oh, sure, yeah. This was supposed to be 2 to 4 centimeters of snow, Chris. That's what they said, right? The weather does what she does what she wants to do. Okay, I only have a couple of minutes. I got a bunch of stuff yet because it's the big weekend for the Stolen Sisters Memorial March. You know, they do this every year to honor and raise awareness about all the many, many missing women and girls and Two-Spirit people. So Sunday at 11 at Pandora in Victoria, the march starts at 12. And then in Vancouver, they're doing it the 14th. At Maine and Hastings, and the family will gather at 10:30, and then everybody else will be marching a little bit later than that, I think around noon, yeah. And then there's also Seattle is holding a candlelight memorial on the 14th as well. And then finally, the Wilderness Committee is saying on February 14th we should stand up for what we love, and so they want us to be on the front lawn of the legislature, and I guess you can bring whatever the heck kind of sign you want on this day, and this is, I think, sort of launching, let's get moving on what we're going to do for the next election. So at noon on the legislature, they're going to have speakers from First Nations and environmental movements and stuff like that, and because the legislature will be having their opening ceremony, they're actually going to go to work, apparently.
Oh, no, really? They're sitting this time. That can't last.
Well, hopefully not, right? Let's get some kind of change, and yeah.
Well, yeah.
I mean, thankfully, you know, one thing, and people talk about whether who to vote for and vote locally or vote for the party or this or that. But you know what happens is if you have to go to your MLA's office to get some help, think about who you want in that office, right? Who's going to help you the most? Really, that's what I think it comes down to.
Well, yeah, where the rubber hits the road. Well, all right. Well, Ginny, is that all then, or?
Well, that's what I got.
Well, okay. Well, you got more than that because your radio show alternates with Manny Najeri's Hidden News, 11 a.m. Thursday, right here. And it's you tomorrow, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yep.
So are you doing that a live show or is that a tape show?
No, it's pre-tape with some film festival interviews. And, yeah, I'm really enjoying the film festivals. People can afford it. Get out there and go see some amazing films.
Well, great plug, and that leads well into my next segment with Jamie Kastner, and he's got a film, The Skyjacker's Tale, that's going to be screened tonight, in fact, at 9:45, if it's still as scheduled.
Well, awesome, and you know, I should mention I'm blogging, too, at myfestivalreviews.blogspot.com.
Okay, could they have a longer address?
Myfestivalreviews.blogspot.com, just for my, like, the stuff I'm writing about films I've seen.
Okay. All right, Janine, well, thanks a lot for coming on again, and we'll talk to you the next time, eh?
Okay, thanks, Chris.
All right, then, see you later. Well, now I'm going to take a brief break, and as said, I'm going to scare up Jamie Kastner, who is hopefully in our green room right now waiting to come on. So in the meantime, those, why don't you listen to this?
Attention, police. Please be aware that our happiness and our exuberance should not be a threat to you. Thank you.
Hey, that's Funk Asylum taking no prisoners. Somebody ruined the dinner. Well, this week, Victoria hosts the 23rd Victoria Film Festival, and it's boasting a program of more than 120 theatrical features, shorts, documentaries, animated Canadian and international films, just one of which is The Skyjacker's Tale, Canadian director Jamie Kastner's documentary chronicle of murder and intrigue in the lower latitudes and Ismail Muslim Ali's desperate flight from the law. Now, the genre-busting Kastner, his films include Secret Disco Revolution, Kike Like Me, Free Trade Is Killing My Mother, Django Mania, Recession for Fun and Profit, and of course The Skyjacker's Tale. They've all been screened between them in London and Rotterdam and Toronto's prestigious TIFF, among other places. Welcome to the program, Jamie.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, the world's changed a lot since Ismail Muslim Ali touched down in Cuba claiming asylum. Jamie, now Cuba has resisted the change for a long time, but it seems the world is catching up to them now. Is the law still intent on catching up with Ali?
Well, I'd say that the world has both changed a lot and it hasn't. Watching some of the, or I mean, making, having made, and then watching again when I see it in theaters, some of the footage from, you know, the late 60s Black Power stuff and the struggles of that time, you know, it feels in many ways like we're reading yesterday's headlines. I think that it remains to be seen. So just apropos of the U.S.-Cuba question, I got access to this story and was already kind of knee-deep into filming when, out of the blue, Obama's announcement in December 2014 came about completely by surprise that you know, he was going to take steps to start restoring relations with Cuba. He remains on in the top five of a list of estimated 80 American fugitives in Cuba, and there are many quarters in the United States, certainly many of the types of quarters who are you know, on the ascent power-wise now, who have been clamoring for the heads of these fugitives. Number one on the list is probably Assata Shakur, but Ismail Ali, the star, if you can call it that, in a documentary of this kind, of my film, is certainly in the top five.
Well, now he does have a political provenance, being a Black Panther member himself before returning to his native Virgin Islands. Well, maybe you could set it up a little bit, Jamie. I mean, this is a complicated and a really long, drawn-out case, a brutal murder that happened on a swanky golf course in the American Virgin Islands. Maybe you could set it up and tell us a little bit about where the scene begins.
Well, it's yes, it is. It's a kind of many-headed beast and a very, very intriguing story that fell into my lap completely at random. I can tell you about that in a moment. But basically, the film is based around access to, you know, to Ali. He's one of the top most wanted fugitives, American fugitives in Cuba right now, who had previously been convicted of murdering 8 people on a Rockefeller-owned golf course in the U.S. Virgin Islands in St. Croix, after which he successfully hijacked a plane in 1984 that was going from St. Croix to New York, and he rerouted it to Havana. And after doing, you know, in the scheme of things, a nominal time in prison there, has been living freely ever since. So the film looks at his situation now and then goes back to you know, not only, of course, we got a whole range of points of view and voices in there. Not, I mean, his is certainly the starting point and the kind of through line, but we were lucky enough through the efforts of you know, my team to get all sorts of people to properly cover the periods of the hijacking, the original crime, and also this incredible trial that ensued, during which Ali and his 4 co-defendants in the murder were represented by the most famous lawyer in America at the time, William Kunstler, a self-described radical lawyer who was sort of hot off the heels of defending the Chicago 7 at the time. He went down to St. Croix to take on this case. So it's It's a rich brew, that's for sure.
Well, and not only that, now, I mean, documentary filmmaking is not exactly lucrative if your name doesn't end with Moore, but you also had to, you know, travel far.
I'm thinking of changing my name, actually. Yeah, you've given me an idea.
Well, do it now. But you went down to Cuba, and now Cuba may have changed a lot in the recent years, but it still is a very, it still is a communist nation, and there is a bureaucracy there, and did you go the legit route and get filming permits and everything else to do this above board, or did you kind of do this a little bit on the guerrilla side?
I think there's always a guerrilla aspect to documentary filmmaking, as you kind of astutely characterized the entire métier. And in this case, it was sort of exponentially sensitive, because one is dealing with a lead character who both is on, you know, has been a long time on the FBI's most wanted list. So the Americans are very curious about where he is, and I never do reveal, nor will I today, if you forgive me, just where he is in Cuba. So you're dealing with, you know, kind of got a lot of scrutiny and curiosity from that side. And also, he is a guy who has nowhere left to go in the world other than Cuba, and so he was very sensitive about not wanting to offend his hosts. Not that I would say there's anything in the film, in my opinion, that could be construed as offensive towards Cubans. But in any case, so there were kind of it was double sensitivity from both sides. So let's just say, without getting into all sorts of details, that yes, I treaded fairly, very carefully all around, and, you know, as under the wire as possible.
Well, now, he's always maintained his innocence of the crime, but it happened, as I said earlier, in the American Virgin Islands, a smallish place where people tend to know each other. It was probably the most vicious crime that they'd seen up until that time, the murder of eight people, some of them killed execution style at this very swanky golf course, a golf course owned by one of the Rockefeller family. Can you lay it out to us? I mean, he says he's innocent, and I won't ask you if you think he is or isn't, but does he show remorse for at least what happened to those people on the golf course?
Well, as he says, I mean, you're raising all sorts of interesting questions, and I think that including the, you know, which we do get into in the film, there are many sides to every story, you know, as I've learned, even doing films on such relatively trivial subjects as disco, you know, my last film, even that, to the people who are passionate about that, there are many histories and often conflicting. Well, the same principle definitely applies with something as fraught as the subject matter of this film. And even while you're absolutely right, it is still my sense of going down to the U.S. Virgin Islands is that this crime, 40 years later, is still viewed for some reason as the most notorious crime on the island. And Ishmael Labit, as he was then known, or Ali, as he is now, he changed his name in prison at some point and converted. He is still kind of like, you know, a dark, mysterious criminal figure that you know, whose specter kind of looms over the island. You know, prior to this film coming out, there were he crops up regularly in news stories. There, is he living among us? Has he changed his identity? Did he go to Angola to fight with the Cubans? You know, he remains a figure of fascination. What he says in the film, now, I mean, I don't want to give too much away. I want to encourage people to come, but you've pointed that out, and that's fair. He has maintained his innocence, and he has said that he has never set foot on the Fountain Valley Golf Course. So that's his answer. I mean, he has, from that point of view, to answer your question, I don't think that there's anything for which he personally, under those circumstances, assuming that's true, has anything to show remorse for. In the end, there are many parts to this film, and part of that, I mean, I think, again, you're touching on very interesting things, of course. And I encourage people to come and see the film and make their own judgment about this guy and this story. It's by no means cut and dry. For me, that was part of what attracted me to the story. It's there were many layers and many versions, and it's just very rich. It's very, very rich material.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Jamie Kastner. Jamie is the director of The Skyjacker's Tale, which is airing as a part of the 23rd Victoria Film Festival tonight at 9:45 at the Odeon 5. Is that still right? Is that still the right?
That's correct.
Well, now,
I'm sure all the snow will have melted by then.
Everybody
will have bought snow tires.
Take the bus, everybody, because people don't have snow tires around here, believe me.
I noticed.
Well, now, Jamie Kastner's other films are, as he mentioned, The Secret Disco Revolution, Kike Like Me, Free Trade is Killing My Mother, Django Mania, Recession for Fun and Profit, and, of course, this film. And you did very well at the TIFF earlier, and your films have shown in other prestigious places. How does the Victoria Film Festival square up against, like, that little old one in Toronto?
That little one in Toronto. Well, I can't even remember it. It's erased the memory of it. Now that I'm Victoria, there is no other festival. No, it's lovely to be here. It's my first time in Victoria altogether. I'm here with my wife, who's also my co-producer and son, and she went to a school out here. She's always raved about it, and it is indeed very beautiful, even in the snow.
Even when it's
and, no, the festival has a really impressive lineup altogether. I'm really honored to be part of it. It's a very very well curated event. I'm not only saying that because they chose my film. I'm talking about the other films they've got in the program, and it's been cool meeting local filmmakers and getting a better sense of the stuff that's going on here. So I'm delighted. Yeah, no, it seems like a very cool festival.
Well, you and your production company, which you mentioned your wife is a part of, Cave 7 Productions, you've also got some attention a little further afield than Little Old Canada as well. I understand Strand Releasing has picked up this film as well to further distribute. Do you have any particulars on that deal? How are they going to go to festivals?
They're a great American, kind of boutique American distributor, and they are going to release the film theatrically for starters. At some point in the spring, a date has not been confirmed yet, but I'm very excited to be working with them. And of course, it'll be very interesting to have the film come out in the U.S. altogether, in Trump's America specifically. And you know, also I hear that since the initial launch at TIFF and the press the film got there, word has reached the Virgin Islands, and they're buzzing about it. I mean, it's going to be like explosive. Although I do think the film is a very good quality, I'm just talking about, you know, just access, you know, as I've described to you, the importance of this character. So for these people to be able to get a glimpse of him after all this time is going to be really something to behold. Whether I'll be, you know, taking my life in my hands to go down there to witness this, I don't know.
Well,
in any case,
do you think you would, though? Do you think that the people down there would take issue with the
you
way?
You haven't seen. Forgive me for I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you haven't seen the film yet, right?
I've seen what you've offered
you've
website.
Seen parts of it. There are revelations. Let me tell you this. Without giving too much away, that we were lucky enough to be able to get revelations on camera as part of this film that are I think going to change people's perception of this case and this story moving forward. And currently the Innocence Project in the US are looking into reinvestigating and making efforts to reopen the original trial based on revelations in the film. It's very something else that's very exciting that's brewing that I'm happy to tell you about. So, without giving you too many specifics, because
right.
I want people to come and see what I'm talking about in the film. This is all kind of part of what's come out of it, which is very thrilling and quite novel for me. I mean, it is a really rare, as you say, nobody gets into documentaries for the money. And I have certainly, you know, had a kind of political, social interest in the subjects and films I've made so far. But this is definitely a new direction for me. It's a kind of investigative true crime type thing. It's been very exhilarating and interesting to make. And it would be quite thrilling because it's a rare thing to actually have a film accomplish something quantifiable, like affecting people's, you know, affecting the lives of three guys who have been rotting away in jail for 45 years, for mm-hmm. instance.
Well, and this, as exciting and as dramatic as Ali's escape was with hijacking the airliner and everything, I mean, you could say that he spent years and years in American prisons and filing appeals and going through this, you know, dogged legal pursuit that could be looked at as just a stepping stone to the his eventual escape.
Well, that is, he's certainly a very bright guy, and he became a kind of jailhouse lawyer, exactly as you say, mounting his own appeals during the course of which he wound up sort of creating precedents and correcting things that had slipped through the cracks in terms of the territorial versus mainland law in the U.S. And in turn, I'm getting, you know, the legal education my mother had always hoped for in the course of making this film. I'm just trying to keep up with him. So he was definitely a very astute guy who tried, you know, by his own account, granted, but you know, the record holds this up. He tried to appeal legally. First of all, you know, these guys were convicted of this crime, and this trial transcript, I've got to tell you, it's unbelievable to look at the story of what happens in this trial. I mean, it was something. Let's just put it that way. We get to some of the fairly shocking stuff in the film, but there was even more that didn't even fit. So these guys were kind of sent off island, partially because they had, yes, on one hand, they were these notorious criminals by the people who had decided that they were responsible. On the other hand, they were kind of symbols of the shitty deal that the poor local population was getting in this, you know, American colony, which is basically what the U.S. Virgin Islands are. And so they were shipped as far away from the island as possible to serve their time. So one of the things that Ali and his co-defendants had been appealing for years was to try to get shipped back to the Virgin Islands, where they could not only be, you know, just in prison, be close to their families, but also where Ali specifically was sure that he had a base of support from which he could, you know, get out of jail legally, you know, mount a meaningful appeal and walk out the front door, as it were. But for all his efforts, many of which were successful to a point, they were never going to let him back on that island. That was clear. And that's when he took matters into his own hands with the plane.
Well, you mentioned the rock star lawyer, William Kunstler, but also in on the case was Michael Ratner and his wife, Margaret Ratner Kunstler, who was married
at different times to each of them.
now, don't throw this into the film. It's going to be.
There were other lawyer. Sorry, not to make you forget your question completely, but there were other lawyer kind of marriage divorces going on. I mean, it was a whole. You could make a whole Downton Abbey on the islands about this thing.
Well, now it's starting to sound like Fleetwood Mac, but Margaret Ratner Kunstler is also in the film, right?
Yes, we were lucky enough to get her. She had been the wife of Michael Ratner, then subsequently married William Kunstler, and I guess in a wonderful kind of 60s, 70s way, they all remained very, very good friends. Kunstler himself, sadly, is not around anymore, but both of those other lawyers were. She was part of the original, she's a lawyer as well, she's a criminal lawyer as well, and she was a key part of the defense team. And Michael Ratner, who is a very interesting kind of civil rights, well, sadly died just about a year ago, mm-hmm. But civil rights type lawyer who launched class action suits for the prisoners in Guantanamo, did some work for Julian Assange, among other things. and also had worked on the appeals for this case, and was kind of an expert on U.S.-Cuba relations as well, which is why I originally approached him, not having even fully realized that he had worked on this case. I was originally just talking. Anyway, we have a great, we have lawyers from both sides. We amazingly got to some cops who talk about what went down. You know, within the airplane section, we have the pilot, we have flight attendants, we have passengers. I mean, full credit to my research team for really knocking it out of the park. I mean, these are the kind of voices you really want when you're trying to bring an old story to life.
Well, and it's a fascinating story and a complicated one, and I salute your attempts to tell it. It's going to be aired. Jamie Kastner's film, The Skyjacker's Tale, is going to be aired tonight as a part of the film festival at 9:45 at the Odeon 5 down there on Yates Street. Thanks a lot, Jamie, for coming on the show and telling us a little bit about it today, eh?
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, my great pleasure. Of course, I want to also thank Joyce Nelson and Janine Bancroft and all the good people that make things happen here week in and week out, and tell you to stay tuned to your Voice of Victoria for more great programming. Linda's next. That's all I got for this week.